My name is Richard Hill. It's now my pleasure to welcome to First Tuesday Rainy Day Radio a friend and very important spokesperson and activist based in New Haven, Connecticut, Art Perlow. Art, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Richard.
It's great to have you. I just want to say a word about Art. Art is a member of the State Committee of the Connecticut Communist Party and an occasional contributor to peoplesworld.org. And peoplesworld.org, Art, is used to be a print paper as well as online. Is it just now online?
It is now just online, but there are fresh articles posted every day. And let me just plug the site. There are some really fine articles which go beyond what you get on a lot of places, including places that are on the left. And it also has great working class coverage in general. Every year it wins awards from the International Labor Press Association because of its coverage of the union movement and of working people's struggles.
Well, we invited you here tonight to talk about an article that you wrote for the peoplesworld.org, and I'll just say the title of it, Tediously Analyzing Biden Won't Get Us Far. It's time to mobilize and organize. And I just want to say that, it, as the title of your article implies, there's a debate taking place in many quarters of the left expressing doubt in the value of working toward this imperfect, not truly progressive ticket of Biden and Harris. And some are considering sitting out the election or voting for a third party. Could you talk a little bit more about the doubts being expressed by some on the left and why you think that is counterproductive to the left?
Right. Well, yes, I have heard those arguments, less actually hearing them as seeing them posted on Facebook or occasionally in supposedly left-wing blogs or sites. But I view the left a lot more broadly. And although the article addresses some of those points, that's I don't feel that that's dominant. And actually, I hear that less and less. And I don't hear it at all when I knock on, I've been knocking on dozens of doors in my neighborhood, which is a diverse, low to middle income, working class neighborhood. And I haven't heard that at all on any of those doors. And in terms of why it's counterproductive, I would say look at what almost every progressive union, environmental organization, women's or anti-racist movement says. Listen to what Bernie Sanders and AOC say, that this election is not about electing Joe Biden. It's about building and strengthening our movements first to stop a fascist takeover in our country. And beyond the inauguration of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, to have a much more favorable playing field for our movement. And the people and organizations in the front lines of struggles confronting corporate power are also in the front lines of the fight to elect Biden-Harris. So if you are more than an armchair radical and want a voice in these movements, well, your claim to a voice and to leadership in struggles today and in the struggles that there will be after the election will be judged not by how precisely you analyze the nature of Biden and Harris and the corporate Democrats, but by how effectively you organize our families, neighbors, friends, and coworkers, and how we participate with our unions and community and environmental organizations, anti-racist organizations, to register voters, turn them out, secure the vote, and win a sufficient landslide for Biden and Harris that will be able to counter any coup that the Trump forces are plotting.
So you're talking about linking the political organizing on all these issues, racial and economic justice, the environment, workers' rights, Medicare for all, protection against eviction, and many other issues, linking them to the fight to dump Trump and to elect Biden and Harris. Could you dig in a little bit on how this strategy is a good way to advance the interests of what Occupy Wall Street used to call the 99%, as opposed to the top 1% or 0.01%.
Right. And, you know, I don't expect a victory in this election to win everything we would want for the working class or the 99%, however you term it. But I would say that, look, for the 99%, just having a rational approach to the pandemic public health crisis, just having appointments to the National Labor Relations Board who are not out to destroy unions, to the Environmental Protection Agency who are not out to destroy the environment, who will reinstitute the EPA rulings on gas mileages, even those minor steps are important and make a real difference to the 99%. But I would say that it goes a lot further than that. That if you are concerned about more far-reaching programs like Medicare for All and the Green New Deal, which are very important for the 99%, there's a big difference between an administration which takes steps in that direction, which we feel are inadequate and which we need to organize for and push further, and an administration which is rolling back on all of those points, destroying what protection there is in the Affordable Care Act, actively destroying the environment, and all our protests and mobilizations can best slow them down and somewhat mitigate the disaster. So if you're talking about the 99% in a concrete way, your neighbors, the person down the street who might be evicted because their $600 a week supplemental unemployment was cut off by the intransigence of the Republicans in the Senate, then yes, it makes a big difference.
We're speaking with Art Perlow. He's a member of the State Committee of the Connecticut Communist Party, and he contributes also to peoplesworld.org. And Art, that, I guess, is the address if you want to get that paper. I'm not sure if you have to subscribe to it or if you can just log in and look at it.
No, you just log in, peoplesworld.org, and if you like it, there's a place on the website you can click and sign up, and twice a week they'll send you headlines. But there are articles, new articles posted every day, and if you really like it, there's a button you can click to donate, because that's what keeps it in business.
Oh, well, then we have that in common right here at WPKN.
Right.
Well, anyway, I just want to go a little further with your article, which, again, I think is, it's sort of a working paper for people on the street trying to make change and do it in a way that is logical and common sense, that is not too ideological and, as you said, armchair radical. But how do we actually get to the goals we are seeking, which are progressive change? And there's this election on November 3rd, which is you, me, so many others agree that Biden is not the knight in shining armor who's going to make it all happen, but that he is somebody that can be talked to, that can be pushed, that mass movements can actually influence. I wanted you to point out that in your article, you mentioned that the mobilization to defeat Trump is happening largely outside the structures of the National Democratic Party, which most progressives, including myself, identify as kind of a neoliberal and corporate organization with a lot of power and a lot of money. But could you talk a little bit about that and point to possibly some historic examples of this kind of extra-party organizing by the left?
Sure. Let me say that it's not just a matter of that we can influence Joe Biden. It's a matter of what kind of movements we build. And this is very explicit. A lot of the organizing being done in this election are being done by unions, by climate activists, by youth, women, racial justice, community grassroots movements, and they are not constrained by any corporate agenda. And also, the broad range of groups that grew out of the Bernie Sanders campaign and the upsurge in progressive political action that elected AOC and the Squad and other progressives to Congress, and including Move On and Our Revolution and DSA and, of course, the Communist Party. But concrete examples, for instance, Unite Here, which is the union representing workers at Yale University, is mobilizing its membership in swing states like Florida, Arizona, Nevada, and Pennsylvania. They're turning out for progressive local candidates, but also for Biden and Harris. And their message, when they go to their members and say, we want you to participate in a phone bank, they say explicitly, and this is a quote, this isn't just about taking Trump out of office. It's about taking back our power and taking back our future. It's about taking back our lives. So they are explicitly using this election to build their strength and organization. So they're in a position to take advantage of a Biden administration. Electing Biden opens a door. It's up to movements like this to go through that door in order to win union representation for low-wage workers, so that they can get better wages and benefits, to win justice for undocumented immigrants, which this particular union and increasingly the whole labor movement is leading in. And there are examples like this all over the country, whether it's the steel workers in western Pennsylvania or Native American activists in Montana and everywhere in between. So their agenda, and I believe all of our agendas, should be to use this election to organize and mobilize, first so that we can elect Biden, Harris, not because we love everything about them, but because that gives us a better playing field on which we can fight for Medicare for all, for a Green New Deal, for union rights and jobs, and et cetera.
Yeah, well said. It might be interesting to compare this kind of movement building and extra Democratic Party activism and mobilization that's happening now to what happened in the lead up to the election of Barack Obama in 2008. Do you have any insight about that, about any qualitative or quantitative comparison between what happened to elect Barack Obama and what's happening now?
Well, you know, there was a big upsurge to elect Obama in 2008. I know I traveled to Philadelphia with Unite Here doing door knocking in Pennsylvania for Barack Obama. And this was not through the Democratic Party structure. This was through the union structure. But I don't think it was on this scale or this level of organization. And after Obama was elected, whether deliberate or not, there was a certain feeling that, well, we've won. Let's all go home. That's an exaggeration, but in fact, the right was able to mobilize in reaction to Obama's election much more effectively than the very broad mass movement which elected Obama was able to mobilize. So basically, Obama was faced the first couple of years in some ways playing defense and unable to move even the agenda that they wanted to, much less an agenda pushed by progressive forces. But I think that the situation is different. You know, it's not just about winning an election in November. There's going to be a huge struggle, and we have no idea its nature or its outcome, but it will probably last at least through November and maybe into the new year to verify the results of the election and to see who actually gets power. And that's going to put millions of people in motion. So that has the potential to go a lot further. And if we win that, to say, okay, now we want the fruits of our victory, and we're not going to stop here. We're not going to disband all the contacts we've made in the grassroots organizations, and we're going to keep up fighting for the reasons why we're in this fight.
We're speaking with Art Perlow. You say in your article that it would be a mistake to underestimate the historic victory of tens of millions of people, including your neighbors and coworkers and colleagues, if it could propel Harris and Biden to prevail over Trump. Describe some of the forces that are out there arrayed in support of reelecting Trump at any cost and against a free and fair election. Like, what are we contending with here?
Yeah, well, you know, a lot has been said about the Trump's core supporters, which is a significant mass base, and their toxic mix of white nationalism, misogyny, deliberate ignorance. And it's being steadily transformed into an organized fascist movement. And it's also expanded its always present base in the military and police forces at all levels. But I think that description misses the essence of the threat and of the forces that are supporting Trump. Because that base of fascist influence core supporters would not be a threat without the significant section of the U.S. ruling class that's supporting the Trump agenda. You look at the military-industrial complex, which is blossoming from a ballooning budget, the fossil fuel industry, Big Pharma, which has a blank check to fleece not only the government but the American people. The administration's one legislative accomplishment was the giant tax break for the 1%. Corporations have green light to ignore any environmental, civil rights, or worker safety regulation. We can go on and on. Trump has made it plain that even when faced with a pandemic, his highest priority is the stock market and the wealth of the 1%. So whatever they think of Trump personally, the most greedy, reactionary, and short-sighted section of capital is decisive both for its financial support for Trump and Republican candidates and its control and influence in the media and the broader economy. And we should remember that when Hitler was handed power in January 1933, his movement was already declining. He won fewer votes than the communists and socialists combined. But Hitler went to the top financiers and industrialists, and he promised that he would restore order, crush the troublesome Reds, eliminate unions, and protect their profits and their power. And the business elite made a few phone calls, and Hitler, who never won an election, was appointed chancellor, and he used that executive office to consolidate power and keep his promise to the German ruling class, while, of course, breaking all his populist promises to the German people. And if that sounds familiar, it's no coincidence.
Well, that's well stated. What I want to ask you is, it seems almost inconceivable, given the chicanery that's going on pre and probably during and post-election, that the Democrats can win on November 3rd. Given the countless, you know, dirty tricks, the voter suppression, the intimidation, the disinformation, the legal maneuvers that voters are facing. But should Biden pull it off and win on November 3rd or sometime in the next week or two after that, what battles will immediately ensue, beginning with Biden's inauguration, as they did the very day that Barack Obama was sworn into office, with Mitch McConnell's declaration that his main goal in the next 4 years was to make Obama a one-term president. So what will Biden have to contend with to counter reaction and really proto-fascist mobilization that's probably going to happen right after he gets elected?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's inconceivable that Biden will be inaugurated and become president. I don't have a prediction one way or the other, but against all the factors that I've talked about and you've talked about, fascism doesn't take over in a night. There are still many institutional structures which, while they are not necessarily on the side of the working people, are on the side of a relatively orderly government with at least with a democratic facade, at least. And so, for instance, I talked about the sections of the ruling class that are in back of Trump. But after all, there are significant sections of the ruling class which are supporting Biden. And in fact, one of the complaints of people on the left is that Biden is in fact representative of the corporate Democrats. And we should not sneer at the importance of an alliance of everybody who wants to stop Trump, whether we agree with them on all points. And also, we should recognize that if the election was fair, Biden would probably win with the biggest landslide, at least since 1964. Trump and the Republicans have never represented a majority of the voters, much less a majority of the people. But to get back to your question, what do we face, and what would a Biden administration face? Well, first of all, there are the objective problems that, in fact, any administration is going to face. We are in a serious recession, and it will be much worse by January. There was mass homelessness and hunger, which have been limited by the CARES Act, but all those provisions have expired or will expire. So there'll be a crisis of living for millions of people. The health system will be in deeper crisis due to the increase in people without insurance. And just when we need them to step up to the plate, schools and other government services will be facing budget cuts and layoffs. And of course, there's the COVID pandemic and the challenge of administering vaccines when and if they are developed. So these are all objective problems, and they're not trivial. And of course, an ultra-right force that's determined to block any efforts to solve them is a big problem. Because as you've indicated, there is a substantial fascist base, which is lavishly funded by ultra-right billionaires, that won't accept the legitimacy of the outcome, and Fox News will be in their corner, and we can expect widespread and violent resistance with substantial elements in the various police forces who will be their allies. We have to remember, even in the Obama administration, the Border Patrol was pretty openly defying the president and launching terror raids on immigrant communities. And another challenge that we'll face is around policy. For instance, when Trump was giving away trillions to the 1%, there was little media attention to the resultant deficits. But with a Democratic administration taking office in a deep recession, just as there was with Obama, expect a sudden shift to concern about the deficit and laments that we cannot afford jobs, health, education, climate action, or even Social Security because they cost too much and the country is broke. So I don't know how a Biden-Harris administration and a Democratic Congress will respond. In some areas, like response to the pandemic, I expect they will at least be competent. But for people like us, for the unions, for the people who are going to propel Biden and Harris to victory, the difference is that instead of playing defense, as we did in 2017 when Trump took office, when we had to go all out to save health care for millions of people under the ACA, such as it is, instead we'll be on the offensive for Medicare for all, which is the only rational response to the pandemic and the recession. And we can extend that to the issues of the Green New Deal, climate change, police accountability. The grassroots organizing that we do to elect Biden-Harris can help build the organizations and the structures necessary to counter the right-wing threat. But it's going to be a huge struggle. My sense of history, I'm not a professional historian, is in spite of huge differences, you have to go back to the election of 1860 for a comparable situation. When Lincoln, once elected, there was a question of could he even take office. He had to sneak into Washington for fear that he would be assassinated en route. And of course, we know what came afterwards in terms of the resistance to even the very modest program that he had advanced. But in the course of the victory that was won, a much more radical agenda emerged. So that's the possibility. It's not a guarantee, though.
Well, Art Perlow, as we wrap up here, I just want to mention you all are listening to WPKN in Bridgeport, 89.5 FM, and streaming online at WPKN.org. So last question I wanted to ask you is that putting in the context of our country, which has faced the threat of fascism in the past from both within and from without during World War II, but leading up to that, and a huge fascist movement was taking shape in this country. You suggest that we'd be confronted with a fascist America if Trump were to win a second term. What would be the face and impact of American fascism in the 2020s? What would be some of the characteristics of it?
Well, you know, fascism, as I said earlier, does not come in one fell swoop. Trump has spent 4 years sort of implementing creeping fascist measures, planting people in key positions, but it can't be done overnight. But I think what we will see, first of all, in terms of how it affects people every day, what we will see is conditions getting measurably worse for the majority of the working class, especially low and moderate wage workers and people of color, with attacks on health care, social security, unions, education, environment, and more, as well as tax increases as state and local governments struggle to keep up with the situation. But I would say those aren't unique to fascism. Those are part of the Republican program in general. But I think what we'll see is that Trump and his circle of ideologues and far-right corporate sponsors will move aggressively to further seize control of the judiciary and all parts of the executive, including the military, the police, and the intelligence services. Congress will be further sidelined. The lock her up slogan that they deployed against Hillary Clinton in 2016 is likely to be translated into criminal proceedings against political opponents and against mass movement. You know, Hitler moved first against the communists and then against the socialists and the trade unionists, and eventually he locked up anybody who opposed him. I suspect that I don't have a crystal ball, but I think we should take Trump at his word, because so far, in a lot of the respects, he does what he says he will. And he will go after his political opponents who are centrist Democrats, people like Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton. At the same time, he is going after not only Antifa, but he will associate anybody who resists as part of Antifa, but he will go after the climate justice movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, the unions. Anybody who resists will feel the weight of one or another form of repression.
Thank you so much, Art. That was a very incisive analysis, and we really appreciate it. We've been speaking with Art Perlow. He's a member of the State Committee of the Connecticut Communist Party, and he contributes to peoplesworld.org. So thanks so much again for being with us. Let's keep in touch and try to follow this thing as it approaches D-Day, so to speak, on November 3rd and beyond.
Well, thank you, Richard. It's been fun as much as discussing this topic can be fun.
Well said. Thank you so much, Art Perlow. Bye-bye.